control aspect to this. So, Nick.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Mary Lou, and welcome to everybody here. Thank you all for coming. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk to you today about one of my favorite subjects, which is the light brown apple moth. And I've been involved in research on this insect for some time now, and I want to just give you some of the insights that we have gained from looking at this rather interesting insect. Invasive species. We all know how important invasive species can be. We have approximately 50,000 exotic species in the U.S., not all of which are a problem. Some of them arrive and are pretty innocuous in the environment, while others can be particularly important problems. And the destructive ones, the destructive invaders, such as some of these ones that you see here, the zebra mussels, Labesia in the grapevines, and the spotted wing Drosophila, these are the things that we tend to have greatest interest in because they can impact our agricultural crops or they can impact our indigenous species. The light brown apple moth is an Australian migrant. It's an interesting little insect. It's a leaf roller. It has quite an interesting life cycle. It has egg masses that are quite difficult to find on the plants. It rolls leaves of a lot of different plants, pupates, and the adult stage of this moth is incredibly variable in its coloration. Its region of origin, its home, is in this part of Australia, the southeastern corner of Australia down into Tasmania. And it's a very, very polyphagous feeding insect. It's got 545 known species of host plants. It's probably got a lot more that it can manage with very easily. It's got an interesting life system to it as well. And that interesting life system is based on the fact that because it's so polyphagous, it can move from one habitat to another through the season. And typically through the winter, it spends its time on weedy plants in semi-natural environments. In the spring, it will move on to ornamental plants in urban environments where there's nice new flushes of growth on various shrubs of one sort or another. And then if things dry up too much in the middle of summer, as has been the case in Australia in recent years because they've had a lot of drought conditions, then this moth will be forced away from the urban environment that it loves so much into the agricultural environment because it's only the agricultural environment that has irrigated plants. You're not allowed to irrigate your shrubs during the summer in Australia, and so those plants are not so suitable for it at those times. So the typical activity in agricultural crops happens around January, end of December through to early February, probably. And grapes and apples are one of the main crops that you tend to find them in. Light brown apple moth was known about in the U.S. for quite some time before this insect arrived here, and various assessments were made of the potential impact that this leaf roller could have should it ever arrive in the U.S. And this was one of the sort of standard predictions that the Department of Agriculture, USDA, through their APHIS branch, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, came up with. This would be the likely distribution of light brown apple moth across the country. And if we look at the four major crops that it's capable of impacting, apples, grapes, oranges, and pears, then it could be responsible for extensive damage to these agricultural production systems. The moth arrived in 2006. It really became a notorious insect because it became a quarantinable pest, and then an eradication program was set up as the immediate management strategy. Its distribution of that at that time was Santa Cruz and San Francisco. Those were the areas that it first invaded, and these were the areas where the eradication programs were set up. And of course, these urban environments is not a situation in which you can undertake an eradication project easily without engendering a lot of public interest in what you might be doing in these areas. There was a lot of concern about using mating disruption as an eradication tool because it's still classed as an insecticide or a pesticide, rather. And there was lots of protests about the eradication program in general. In 2008, that program was switched from focusing on aerial applications of mating disruption pheromones to a sterile insect technology program that was sort of still being generated some years later and has now been closed down. And in 2010, it was realized that actually this insect could not be eradicated. It was too abundant. And so there was a decision made, a regulatory decision made, to switch the management here away from eradication to one of containment and control, still based on the use of mating disruption, still based on some BT treatments, but emphasizing to a greater extent the need to manage this invasive insect through whatever biological control opportunities may arise. So I want to focus on just a couple of important aspects of this insect for you today. And one of the two questions that I want to deal with is, what really is the potential range of light brown apple moth across the North American continent? And secondly, this insect still in 2012 has not become an important agricultural pest in California. So with that in mind, is there any evidence that there may be some resistance to the invasion of this insect up and down the state? And those are the two things I will deal with, and I'm going to focus on this potential range first of all, because I think this is a very important topic in general when we're thinking about invasive species. This is the most recent sort of distribution record for light brown apple moth up and down the western region. It's in California, coastally. It's expanding further south every year. There's one record from Oregon, but it's pretty much confined to coastal California. It might come into the Davis area a little bit, but it hasn't really expanded like some of the other invasive insects that we've seen in recent years. Spotted winged Drosophila is everywhere. Babesia was pretty much throughout the state very soon after it arrived in the state. But light brown apple moth has not been like that. It's stayed to the coast much, much more than was predicted. And so I want to just come back to this model that was developed by USDA APHIS for predicting the range of light brown apple moths as an invasive, potential invasive species in the US. Red is very good for it, yellow is not so good, blue is maybe marginal areas for it, and white is not suitable environment for this insect. This is actually, if you think about this map, you might think, well, actually that looks quite like the sort of plant growth zones across the country. And essentially, that's about what this model is. It's based on accumulations of temperatures above the threshold temperature for development of this insect. That's all it is. And that is not a very effective model for predicting the potential range of an insect as an invasive species. This was a very interesting point that was questioned some time ago, and the APHIS people who developed these models for invasive species were asked, well, can you show us how well this model works for predicting the range of light brown apple moth in its region of origin and perhaps in other parts of the world also? So APHIS did that, and they said, yeah, perfect, we can do that. This is the prediction for other parts of the world. Here's Australia. Red is very good environment for light brown apple moth. Yellow is okay. Blue is marginal. Tasmania is a perfect place for light brown apple moth. That is probably one of the main areas that it occurs in. And you might notice here that some of the other perfect places for light brown apple moth are equatorial regions of the world, desert regions of the world that seem to be absolutely perfect for this insect. So when you see something like that, you instantly think, wow, this really cannot be a good representation of potential geographic ranges of light brown apple moth. And if this is the standard model that is used by APHIS to predict potential ranges of any invasive species across the US, we probably ought to be concerned about any prediction that comes out of this agency, because they're using a model that is just simply based on accumulated temperature above a lower threshold for development. That doesn't tell us anything about potential distributions. What does determine distributions is three different factors. And the three different factors are abiotic elements of the environment, biotic elements of the environment, and the dispersal capabilities of the organism of interest. And this sort of diagram quite nicely captures the intersection of these three different factors and how they will influence distributions. This blue circle here is how abiotic conditions influence an organism. So that you might think of more in terms of the fundamental niche of the exotic invader might be contained in that blue circle. But there are going to be biotic interactions with other elements of the resident community that's invaded. That's this circle. And so that region might be more like the realized niche of an invasive species. And there are different types of models that you can use to predict distributions of invasive species, some of which predict fundamental ranges, and others of which predict more like the realized niche of an invasive species. And so what we've done is we've taken a couple of different modeling approaches to try and get a better estimate of the potential distribution of light brown apple moth. And one thing that is really clear, although a lot of species distribution modeling has appeared in the literature over the last 10 to 15 years, there's a lot of uncertainty in these models. It's very difficult to capture all of the factors that are likely to influence distributions of organisms. And particularly when you're dealing with new invasive species, it's going to be extremely difficult to be able to predict how that new invader is going to interact with resident biotic elements of the environment. So the use of more than one type of model is always a good approach to trying to look at potential geographic ranges. So for light brown apple moth, we took two approaches. One is a more mechanistic model based on known biology of the insect. And the program Climax, developed in Australia, has been around for decades and was developed very particularly to capture the biology of invasive species and to predict ranges that way. But also, more recently, there are a lot of more correlative modeling approaches which just are based on known distributions of organisms in their regions of origin. And you capture the climate that characterizes those known distributions, and then you can subsequently use that to map onto a different geographic region the potential favorable climatic environment that they might find there. So we use these two different approaches. There have been a nice survey done in southeastern Australia for light brown apple moth, and these dots represent all the locations where light brown apple moth was found in Tasmania as well as the mainland here. And this was all done over a period of 2 years. And we took this presence data and we put it into the MaxEnt model. And we used some of this widely available bioclimatic data to develop a model to predict this range in Australia. And the maximum temperature of the warmest month turned out to be the most important of the climatic variables affecting light brown apple moth in this region. But these were some of the other climatic factors that were also built into the model. For climax, you use a lot more detailed information, like the lower threshold for development, the upper threshold for development, and all sorts of indices based on soil moisture and how humidity might impact these insects, as well as how temperature might be impacting these insects. And so that's quite a different approach to modeling the distribution. And this is the simple outcome on a global, from a global perspective, where red represents favorable environment for light brown apple moth, green represents unfavorable environment, and you cycle between the orange and the yellow to get to the green. So for both of these, this is the correlative model based just on presence data from Australia. This red pretty well matches the favorable environment the light brown apple moth occurs in its region of origin. New Zealand has been invaded by this insect. That's shown to be favorable environment. The islands in Hawaii have been invaded. They're shown as favorable environment. And here's the California coastline. You don't see it so clearly here, but this is the West Coast with its favorability of environment here. If we look across these southern states, there's not a lot of favorable environment here. Parts of South America, parts of South Africa are very suitable. But the interesting thing is, despite the very different nature of these two models, correlative model, biology-based model, there's not an exact match between these two predictions, but it's a fairly consistent match. It's a fairly consistent match that neither of these models give the whole of the southern half of the country as favorable environment for this insect. And it looks very much as if the West Coast provides suitable climatic conditions for this insect, but it's not that you're going to get that suitable climate right across the southern states. So that's interesting. That's an interesting contrast to the predictive information that USDA is using to assess the significance, potential significance, of light brown apple moth as an invasive pest. Of course, that's looking at the climate over the last 30 years. But of course, climate's going to change. So does that mean that California 50 years down the road is going to become much more widely suitable an environment for light brown apple moth? So one of the other things that we can do with these models is to project the warming of the environment and how that's going to change the potential distribution for light brown apple moth across the country. And we did this using just one of the two models, Climex, because it's a more biologically based model, and I think I have a little bit more belief in the validity of that model since it's got more biology built into it. And we took a fairly severe representation of the potential for climate change in across the country over the next 50 years or so. 2.88 degrees centigrade rise in temperature by 2080. And we can map how this is going to change the distribution of light brown apple moth. So here you can see California is, coastal California is really the most suitable environment for the insect. What happens as you go through this progression of years is that suitable environment moves northwards, as you might expect. For an insect that is not tolerant of very warm summer conditions, as the climate warms over time, you're going to see these areas up in British Columbia, Washington, again coastal, primarily coastal, but they're going to become more and more suitable environment. California coastline is still going to be suitable, but it's not going to open up other areas of the country to a great extent. There's a little bit of an increase in activity here in 2080. But it's not a vast change, even taking into account the potential for global warming. So I think that's an interesting lesson to be learned about how we think about the potential severity of new invasive species and how, on a national level, we tend to be responding to that. One of the other questions that I wanted to address was this resistance to light brown apple moth invasion. And one thing that we have found over the last few years is that indigenous natural enemies are becoming very important, or resident natural enemies are very important for light brown apple moth. Typically, when you have an invasive species, they don't attract a lot of natural enemy activity from resident natural enemies. Typically, most invasive species have much greater levels of parasitism in their region of origin than they do in the invaded region. And this is a little study that was done back in 1993 by Buck Cornell and Brad Hawkins. Really, most insects in a new region suffer very little from parasitism. And that's why the concept of classical biological control became so popular. In the absence of natural enemies, these invasive species can build their populations to a much greater extent. It's very, very uncommon to see an exotic species attract a lot of attention from resident natural enemies. We've been sampling up and down coastal California, focusing very much on the San Francisco region, where the main host plant for light brown apple moth is the Australian tea tree that grows in San Francisco. In Santa Cruz area, it's the manzanitas, the ornamental manzanitas that are favored by light brown apple moth. And we've been doing some surveying of parasitism in these areas since 2008. And we've done some more intensive surveys in the Berkeley area more recently. And the first thing I want to just tell you about the activity of light brown apple moth, and these different color charts are just for one of our field sites in Santa Cruz, and the different colors represent the different phases of the life cycle, excluding the adults here. Red is first and second instars through to the pupal stage in black. And this is the pattern of activity or the age structure of the population across time, across these years. And really the only take-home message I want you to take from this is that almost every stage in the life cycle is present at every time of the year. There are not discrete generations of light brown apple moth. They're totally overlapping generations, so that any of these stages, juvenile stages of development, can be found at pretty much any time of the year. These are the range of parasitoids, resident parasitoids in California, that we have found through this sampling, attacking various different stages of the life cycle. Egg parasitoids, young larval parasitoids, larval pupal parasitoids, quite a range of them. There's about 17 different primary parasitoids there. That's a lot of different parasitoids. That's typical of what you would see associated with a native leaf roller species. 17 different parasitoids. The ones in red I've highlighted particularly because these are the ones that are really dominant in this assemblage of parasitoids, and they are responsible for quite extensive levels of parasitism. This is just a very simple chart to show you the extent of parasitism by three of these players: the Trichogramma, Meteorus, Ictericus, which is a braconid late larval parasitoid, and Pediopsis nemi is a gregarious pupal parasitoid. Over 80% of the egg masses are being parasitized by Trichogramma fasciatum. We never knew Trichogramma fasciatum occurred in California until light brown apple moth arrived. And now it's parasitizing 80% or more of the egg masses. That's unheard of. Trichogramma never do that to any native insects that we know of. But that's a very impressive level of parasitism. There are 40 to 60 eggs in an egg mass. This parasitoid will parasitize every one of them. Most of our other Trichogramma species will parasitize 10 or 15 eggs in an egg mass, and the rest are fine and healthy. A very unusual parasitoid. This one is parasitizing up to 40% of the larvae, and maybe 50% of the pupae are being attacked. That's huge in terms of levels of parasitism to expect for a tortricid moth. If we went back to Australia and looked at parasitism of light brown apple moth in Australia, you wouldn't actually see quite that level of parasitism in its native region. This is more extensive parasitism than it experiences as a native insect. So what is the significance of this parasitism? What role might that parasitism be playing in terms of the invasion of light brown apple moth? And so we've looked at this in a couple of different ways. And the first way we tried looking at the effects of parasitism was through a stage-structured matrix model. Very simple model, and there's enough information from Australia to be able to develop a baseline matrix model for this insect based on information from Australia. Dan Thanarayana spent many years working on this insect in Australia, and he's developed some life tables for this moth in the Melbourne area of Australia. And we took his information and we developed this matrix model. The one thing we did was we excluded parasitism from this model. We excluded the amount of parasitism that was observed in Australia, because at this time in 2008, we didn't know how much parasitism we were likely to expect in California, and we were really developing this model to look for vulnerability in the life cycle of this insect. If you were to introduce an exotic parasitoid, which stage in the life cycle would be most vulnerable to the addition of parasitism by an exotic parasitoid? Which stage in the life cycle would have the greatest influence on the population growth rate of this insect? So we developed this model, and this was the outcome that we found. Here we've got the outcome of the model plotted in two different ways. Typically, in a stage-structured matrix model, what you'd look for is how survivorship in the different stages of the life cycle contribute to the population growth rate of that insect. And the elasticity gives you a measure of how much that survivorship contributes to population growth rate for the different life stages here. On this side, we've got, if we were to introduce parasitism at any one of these life stages, how much parasitism would be needed at that life stage to reduce the population growth rate of light brown apple moth to zero, so that the population is not being able to grow. And what this tells us down here is that this young larval stage, this is the second to the fifth instar, in fact it covers the young to mid-larval stage here. This was a stage that was developed and used by Dan Thanarayana in his life tables. This is the stage that's most vulnerable to the addition of parasitism. You only need 47% parasitism at this stage to reduce population growth rate to zero. Whereas in the first instar larval stage, you need more than 70% parasitism to reduce population growth rates to zero. So it's a way of looking to see which life stages would be most vulnerable to introduced exotic parasitism. That was how we developed it originally, but it's also very interesting as a way to be able to get a better understanding of how much parasitism is needed at this stage of the life cycle to reduce population growth rates to zero, to stop those populations from growing. So if we look at some of this general sample data, this is the abundance of light brown apple moth over time in one of the two sites that we've sampled consistently in San Francisco. This is the abundance in the second site. This is the extent of parasitism here, going from 0 to 1. And this dotted line is the 47% level. These bars are constructed of both black and white. Black is parasitism that is occurring in L2 to L5. White is additional parasitism occurring at other stages in the life cycle. And so what you can see here is that these black bars exceed the level of parasitism needed to reduce population growth rates of light brown apple moth to zero. Doesn't do it all the time, but it does it at various points through the season, that we're seeing parasitism by resident parasitoids, which is enough to reduce those populations quite severely. So then you begin to think, well, could parasitism really be driving the change in population abundance of this insect in coastal California. And these graphs plot the per capita population growth rate of light brown apple moth against the parasitism rate. And what you can clearly see, this is the two sites, no, sorry, these are the two sites in San Francisco, the two sites in Santa Cruz. And these graphs very clearly show us that parasitism is not driving any change in per capita population growth rate. It may be extensive, but it's not driving any patterns in change in population abundance. So that's one thing that we can learn from that. But here's another interesting element to light brown apple moth in coastal California. If we plot the per capita population growth rate against the light brown apple moth population density at that time, we can see whether there's any density feedback that is happening in light brown apple moth populations in California. And what I think you can see fairly consistently here is we've got some pretty strong declines in population growth rate as light brown apple moth densities increase in each of these four sites. That tells us that we've got some pretty strong compensatory feedback here. And one of the interesting things about this is that the zero population growth rate here occurs at pretty moderate densities of light brown apple moth. Tea tree in San Francisco, manzanita plants in Santa Cruz, see very similar patterns here. That once you get to about 10 to 15 light brown apple moth leaf rolls per minute of search of these shrubs, that's the density at which population growth rate has dropped to zero. At higher densities on these plants, we've got negative population growth rates. So there is something else other than parasitism that is influencing these populations and posing some important constraints on the abundance of light brown apple moth on these ornamental plants. We don't know what those factors are at this current time, but we're interested in finding out more. So I want to just summarize for you what we have learned, some of the things that we have learned about light brown apple moth as a very atypical invasive species. And this is not just in California, but anywhere in the world, light brown apple moth would be a very atypical invader. It really highlighted for us the importance of public relations in eradication programs. We had the most spectacular failure that we have seen in a long time in thinking, in the first place, that we could eradicate this insect, and secondly, the way that we went about doing that. I think the other important thing is that it has highlighted for me the total inadequacy of our national agencies in developing sensible information about potential risks from invaders, because they consistently use a geographic distribution model that makes absolutely no sense at all. And I think that's an important lesson. It's one that I have tried to talk with APHIS about. And to the current point in time, they either don't understand the problem or they don't want to know the problem. And it may be a bit of both. It's very interesting that, like brown apple moth, has attracted far more parasitism from resident parasitoids than we have seen for almost any other insect anywhere else. There's one other great example where a similar thing happened, and that was with Bayberry whitefly in Southern California. Resident parasitoids were responsible for the management of that invader. But I don't know of any other examples where this has happened. Why did it happen? I think there's a very simple answer here. Like brown apple moth does not have a diapause. It has no overwintering diapause. It has no summer aestivation. There's nothing to stop it presenting favorable life stages to adventurous parasitoid species continuously throughout the year. And that lack of a synchronizing factor has allowed resident parasitoids to have a field day. They don't have to be adapted to this new invader. They can use it anytime. And I think that's probably the answer to the extent of parasitism. But I'm really interested in this amazing density feedback that occurs even at moderate densities on these ornamental shrubs. And what factor may be responsible for that? What we've seen more recently is that yellow jackets are perhaps really important predators. And you see them coming into these shrubs consistently, and pulling like brown apple moth out of those leaf rolls. We haven't investigated that yet, but we will be doing so through this coming season. And lastly, I did also wonder whether this feedback could be due to induced plant defenses. Many of the ornamental plants that like brown apple moth feed on have a wide variety of different chemical defenses that are inducible in these plants, but we haven't yet at this point tested whether there is any induction of defenses. It's a polyphagous feeder, so it's not perhaps the most obvious factor that could be causing this biotic resistance, but I think it's an important one that we need to be looking at, and again, we'll be doing that through this coming season. So at that point, I want to draw to a close, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that any of you might have.
Are most of the native parasitoids broad-spectrum parasitoids of leaf-rolling portrices? Do they attack the other polyphagous leaf-rollers in that area?
That's a very good question, isn't it? And that's something that I didn't mention anything about at all. It's a question that we have struggled with, and you might have noticed that I've been referring to resident parasitoids rather than native or indigenous parasitoids. Because in many cases, we don't know that these are actually indigenous species. They may be exotic parasitoids. They tend to be less specialized, as far as we know. Very few of them are known from native leaf rolls. And we don't know what the typical hosts of any of these parasitoids is likely to be. Yeah.
So you sort of glossed over the politics up front, but you know this. But what many of the audience may not know is that the original policy was they were going to spray monthly for 5 years over the entire Bay Area, Monterey, Sonoma, right in there. And so when you say a public relations failure, is this because of PR or because of bad policy? And a second question, what lessons do you think APHIS learned from this? If you talk to APHIS.
Really good point. Was it bad policy or was it just bad PR? I think it was both.
Answer.
I don't think that eradication of a leaf roller through mating disruption is a possibility. It hasn't been demonstrated anywhere in the world that that's a feasible approach to take to eradication. So I think that was a flaw in the first place. I think we just spectacularly failed in the public relations because no effort was made to make the general public aware of the significance, potential significance, or lack of significance of this insect, or what would be involved in the program for eradication.
So you thought it could be eradicated?
I suspect it might have been a possibility to eradicate it through insecticide application.
Well.
And that was clearly not a feasible approach to use. So I think our only good examples of eradication of insects anywhere have involved the use of pesticide applications. I don't think there have been successful examples that haven't. And to use pesticides on that scale in an urban environment is clearly not an option.
So what's that, what example would you cite for pesticide eradication?
I think New Zealand has had some successful programs.
The white tussock moth?
Where they have used a combination of treatments, including pesticides, to eradicate.
There's no examples. There's none. Even the white tussock moth, this was over a pretty restricted area, a couple square
yes.
miles.
Yes, yes.
And so, I mean, scale this up to 10,000 square miles here.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so.
Eradication, you've got to be really quick.
But there's no examples. There's no examples. There's really not. Cite one.
Well, the New Zealand colleagues would clearly suggest that they have been successful and that they have been more successful in their PR approach to eradication of invasive insects. You may be much more familiar with the details of those programs than I am, so I wouldn't question whether, if you suggest there are no examples, then I'm happy to believe that that might be the case.
There's really none.
But I think if there were to be a case, it would involve insecticides. Yeah?
I'm curious about your matrix model result that that parasitoids of the second to fifth instars have so much more of an effect than parasitism to the first instars. Can you explain sort of
why that should be?
Yeah.
Well, the population growth rate of any insect is determined by a series of vital rates that characterize its life cycle. So you've got elements like fecundity that can influence, potentially influence population growth rates. You've got survivorship at different stages of the life cycle that can affect population growth rates. And you've got development rates also play an important role in integrating to give you a population growth rate for a particular insect. So the life strategies, the life cycles of insects can vary a lot in terms of their fecundity versus development times versus typical survivorship through the different stages. And so you can have different points of vulnerability in the life cycle of an insect depending on the characteristics of its life cycle in terms of these vital rates. So population growth rate represents the integration of all of these different life history parameters that are impacting an insect as it goes through its life cycle. And so depending on those vital rates, you can get vulnerabilities in different stages of the life cycle of an insect. And it just so happens that for the characteristics of the life cycle of light brown apple moth, it turns out it's that mid-larval stage, L2 to L5, that has the greatest vulnerability. Any added mortality at that stage in the life cycle is going to affect its population growth rate much more so than added mortality at any other phase of the life cycle. Yes?
Has there any evidence that the species has invaded natural areas in the Bay Area? For example, go out from Manzanita and chaparral and go woodland?
It is in, yes, it certainly does. You know, one of its more recently adopted plants in the coastal region is coyote brush. And Baccharis is really a quite suitable plant for it. And so since we've got a lot of Baccharis in the coastal area, that is certainly going to be a plant that will be impacted by it. But the populations are not that great on Baccharis. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at indigenous plants, exotic plants, it tends not to build up these huge populations except in one or two locations where you've got a particularly favorable setting. Nurseries are perfect because nurseries are full of young plants with very vigorous growth. And that is absolutely perfect for light brown apple moth. So those settings are always going to be at risk. But in the native environment, Baccharis, when it's producing a nice new shoot, if we get enough winter rain for it to do so, then it's going to attract attention from light brown apple moth. But this year, who knows?
This might be interesting to see if the parasitoid communities are different on these native plants in natural areas compared
right.
to the ornamental areas.
We have actually been monitoring that, and there are some differences with host plant. It seems that Australian plants attract a little bit more parasitism than non-Australian plants. That's one pattern that we've been able to find. But otherwise it's hard to know why it is that a particular plant gets a bit more parasitism than another. The characteristics behind that we haven't been able to determine at this point.
Yeah, real quick, I was wondering if LBAM is that unique in terms of its relationship to native parasitoids. It seems the typical response by the biological control community to an invasive